It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mayor Bill Peduto is halfway through his second term, and we went to his office Monday to talk about his priorities for 2020. Mayor Bill Peduto, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
City Council has elected Teresa Kale Smith to serve as council president for the next 2 years. How do you see that selection affecting your own plans?
Well, we work closely with Teresa. My chief of staff, Dan Gilman, is in contact with her already on a daily basis, so it's not going to be much of a change. Still working with her. I think that she is a good candidate in the sense that she really does get along with everybody. So I think that what you saw under the leadership of Bruce Krause was a council that worked more together than against each other, and I think that that will continue with Madam President.
But Kale Smith has expressed some skepticism from time to time of initiatives your administration has supported, most recently the Parks Conservancy tax. Do you anticipate any change of your relationship with the council as a whole and with Council President Kale Smith?
I don't think so. Whenever we have had differences, they've always been professional. They've always been on the issue, and they've never been personal. Teresa and I aren't going to agree, and that's good. That's called democracy. And where we don't agree, I expect her to continue to be professional and make it about the facts of the issue. And I see no reason why that would change.
You begin the new year with a new cabinet member, a new leader within your administration. You recently named Marty Lamar as economic development officer. Why is this position needed?
It's been needed since Kevin Ackland left. Kevin wore two hats as chief of staff and as chief economic development officer, and that was a lot for anyone to try and carry. Since he has been gone, we have been working through committee. Project by project in order to be able to make sure that our economic development strategy carries out. But what it really needs is one person that is sort of pulling together not only the major initiatives and having permitting, license, and inspection, working with the URA, working with the housing authority, working with planning, but also at the same time putting out the fires that come up every single day.
Mr. Lamar's background is as a housing executive. Will he focus on increasing the amount of affordable housing, especially in new developments?
Well, that was one of the key criteria of hiring Marty for this position, is that he has experience leading large organizations in housing, whether in Atlanta, Philadelphia, or Toledo. His background, though, is not limited just to housing, but he has also worked throughout all areas of economic development. And even though it wasn't the only reason that we hired him, having someone in that position with as much experience as he has had in housing was definitely one of the top criteria.
He was most recently regional vice president of McCormick Barron, a development firm that has projects in the city, including a major development in East Liberty Larimer. Because of his history with that company, are there any concerns about conflict of interest? Will he recuse himself from projects involving McCormick Barron?
Well, I think that the experience he's had with the company itself is a benefit. They're recognized around the nation as one of the top affordable housing agencies or companies in all of the country. And certainly the development that we've had in Larimer is something that we want to see replicated. Unless it is involving the selection of McCormick Barron, Mr. Lamar will be working with all of the developers on all the developments within the city. But if it is a question of choosing a developer, he would have to recuse himself from the previous work that he did for that company.
You're listening to The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin in the office of Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Work will be getting underway on a $400 million residential complex in the Strip District. The Strip has been bustling with activity, including work on the terminal building. The Strip is considered an iconic part of Pittsburgh, I think you would agree. How can you alleviate the concerns expressed by some longtime business owners, customers, and even residents of the Strip about the impact on them from all this construction going on in the Strip?
Well, I think if you think about the Strip, especially from the viewpoint of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you really think about a five-block area of Penn Avenue. But what we've seen is Penn Avenue expand. There's now more businesses located along Penn Avenue than during those decades. What we're now going to see is a complementary development along Smallman. And in that area, we'll see a mixed use between offices and restaurants. Complementary businesses, again, that will create that food district. But we're also looking at reconnecting the Strip to the river. We're going to see it with recreation, riverfront trails, riverfront access to amenities that we really haven't looked at before in the Strip.
Let me ask you about transportation and the Strip. At a December meeting, business owners, some were upset about transportation proposals to increase parking costs, push customers to fringe lots. Do you think that could hurt their businesses?
I actually agree with what the concerns of the Strip businesses on Penn Avenue are saying. And in that area where they are, I think that, you know, the way that it is right now doesn't really need to be changed. However, if you go several blocks up Penn Avenue, you'll hear something completely different from the people who have shops up there, where the one-way streets that run through the intersections of Penn make it more difficult for people to get to their stores, and how two-way traffic would help to be able to bring more customers into that area. The Strip isn't one area like it was for decades. It's many areas, and we have to recognize that it's not 1974 anymore, and that we can keep the heart of Penn Avenue the same way that it was back then. But as the area continues to grow from parking lots into prosperous businesses, we need to be able to have multimodal solutions to the problems of today.
The Iowa caucuses are coming up in a few weeks. Pennsylvania primary in about 3 short months. Are you endorsing any of the current Democratic contenders?
Not presently. I've talked with a few of them. I have staked out a position on the continuation of the petrochemical industry in southwestern Pennsylvania, where I feel there should be a moratorium placed on the building of any new cracker plants until we have had an independent evaluation of the public health effects, the environmental effects, and the economic effects, because there are economic opportunity costs associated with this industry, and be able to make an informed decision instead of an emotional decision. I have asked the candidates to support the moratorium on a national basis, and I have asked them also to invest a commitment to invest hundreds of billions of tax credits, incentives, and grants into a program to rebuild the Rust Belt and those areas that are being left behind through the transition away from fossil fuels. Those two issues are the core of what I believe is a pragmatic solution to both our environmental and economic needs for southwestern Pennsylvania. And I'm looking for a candidate who would agree and would help to push a national narrative on that.
Doesn't sound like you've identified one just yet.
I haven't identified one just yet because none have decided to say that they are willing to support both.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. WPXI and WTAE reached agreements over the weekend with cable networks after a brief disruption for viewers, but it's possible that the same issue could happen again. And researchers are trying to restore a tree species they've never seen during their lifetime, the American chestnut. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
REM broke up 8 years ago, and frontman Michael Stipe has remained pretty quiet since then. However, this past October, Stipe released his first ever solo single, the environmentally themed Your Capricious Soul. This past weekend, Stipe celebrated his 60th birthday with the release of his second solo single, Drive to the Ocean. This new song, like the previous one, promotes climate change awareness with proceeds directly benefiting Pathway to Paris, a nonprofit that strives to make the Paris Agreement a reality. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Firearms are used in half of all suicides in the U.S., and for some people, that alone is a reason not to own guns or keep them in the home. But 43% of U.S. households do have guns. WITF's Brett Schultes reports that's why two safety instructors have devised a plan to prevent firearms deaths by giving gun owners a chance to turn in their weapons during a crisis. Just a note of caution. This story includes the sound of gunfire on a shooting range.
They're asking for eyes and ears. You're good. Okay. Hang on. Well, it's gonna go hot in a second here.
Monday nights like this one, Sarah Albrecht works as a range safety officer at gun clubs in Chester County, where she teaches children and teenagers how to shoot. The rest of the week, the 39-year-old works as a doula and childbirth educator.
So I've had clients that, you know, they normally have a great life, and then maybe something happens tragically. Maybe they suffer a miscarriage. Maybe they have a very difficult labor and delivery.
Sarah emphasizes she's not a mental health professional, but she says her job as a doula has taught her about how a mental health crisis can come out of nowhere and how that can put gun owners at increased risk for suicide. Tonight, Sarah is taking a break from her job at the shooting range to talk about the gun violence prevention effort she and her co-founder are calling Hold My Guns.
We are in touch with gun shops across the United States. I think we have about 10 for the pilot program.
This is also personal for her. Sarah knew four people who died by suicide. Two of them used firearms. After dealing with the loss of a family friend who shot herself last fall, Sarah decided gun owners need to be able to take a break from their firearms when they're going through a crisis or struggling with a mental illness.
And our hope is that if people, when they know that things are starting to get out of hand, and they get help and they take a break from their firearms.
This can be harder than it seems. In some states, including Pennsylvania, it's against the law to give a handgun to someone else unless they have a permit. And then, Sarah says, there's the stigma. People don't want to have to explain why they need to get lethal weapons out of their house.
We are also trying to create a sense of community that does relate, that does reduce stigma against mental illness in the gun community.
She and co-founder Genevieve Jones figured out a solution. Existing federal regulations allow gun shops to take someone's firearm for a consignment. Those same laws also allow dealers to take that firearm and hold it for a person who just doesn't want it in their home.
That's the only difference. They will have on the storage tags probably of our logo and for storage only.
The idea has gotten the attention of some state lawmakers. Albrecht gave testimony at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on behavioral health and gun violence, and the project received financial support from a psychiatrist.
And he said that, you know, it's a normal thing for them to just start treatment by confiscating firearms, and that this will change the way that he can interact with his patients and their treatment.
Jones admits tighter gun laws can be a hot-button issue. She says this program sidesteps politics while providing one solution.
You know, me personally, I'm a libertarian, so neither Democrat nor Republican. I have a lot of friends who are liberals. You know, what we really care about is preserving life. We don't really care to tell people that their opinions are wrong.
Jones says it's important to note that firearm dealers do not collect information about people who use the program. And since some people may store a gun for reasons unrelated to mental health, like if children were going to be in the house, then it makes it easier for them to sign away their weapons.
We're not talking about, like, why the person's coming in there or any type of background information like that, because that is a concern that we've heard a lot about.
Like, oh, this may be the only program like this in the country. Sarah and Genevieve think it is, though they also point to efforts like the Colorado Firearm Safety Coalition, which has set up a regional network of firearm storage locations. Still, it has its limits, and of course, it risks falling into largely partisan discussion on gun measures. Sarah and Genevieve note this is a non-legislative and voluntary measure, unlike red flag laws that 17 states and D.C. have enacted that allow a judge and law enforcement to require someone to temporarily turn in their firearms. Sarah and Genevieve don't have an official position on those laws, pointing out that their group, a nonprofit, is also non-political.
I think it's an interesting idea, and we certainly want to incentivize gun owners.
Shira Goodman does have an opinion on that. She's executive director of Ceasefire PA, a group pushing for tougher gun laws, including those extreme risk protection order laws, also known as red flag laws, in Pennsylvania. Goodman says the program's a good idea, but there also need to be ways for families to intervene. To her, people aren't always aware of their own problem or willing to do anything about it.
I think it relies too much on just the voluntary nature of it, right?
Goodman says she knows a woman whose husband died by suicide despite his wife's efforts to remove his gun from his possession. He didn't want to give it up, and she couldn't make him.
We need to create not just pathways for something like this to work, but for other tools for families who realize somebody's in crisis and want to put somebody on a no-buy list, for example.
Not to mention, guns are used in more than 70% of homicides, including those involving a domestic partner where the firearm may have been legally purchased.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, they're much more likely to engage around safety issues when they're hearing it from their colleagues and the people that they trust. And
Dr. Jack Rizel has seen firsthand the results of some of that gun violence.
My first real exposure to guns was as a medical student in Rhode Island, doing a trauma surgery rotation and seeing people with firearm injuries rolling in pretty much every single shift.
Like Sarah Albrecht, Rizel testified before the state Senate and has been searching for ways to prevent gun deaths. He says there needs to be sort of an all-of-the-above approach.
One of the things we know is that access to a firearm is one of our biggest risk factors for suicide and people who are at risk for suicide. And so for them to have a safe alternative place to store that firearm that's away from their immediate access, we're much more likely to be able to get them through that bout of depression or anxiety, get them back on their feet.
He supports some gun control efforts, such as universal background checks. But with more than 300 million guns in the U.S., Rizel says public policy experts need to reach out to gun owners and find ways to help them limit their risk.
It's going to take a lot of small fixes over time.
Sarah and Genevieve think that temporary break from firearms might help people in crisis while lessening the risk of harm to themselves or others.
If that person is willing to go get help, many people change.
They may soon find out. After testing out the pilot program, they hope to make it a mainstay at gun shops around the country. In Chester County, I'm Brett Schultes.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. WPXI and WTAE reached agreements this weekend with the cable and satellite networks that distribute their programming. There was a brief disruption for viewers, but our next guest says it's just a new iteration of an old program, a problem, and it's likely to happen again. Terry O'Reilly has spent most of his career working in broadcast television. Locally, he's the CEO of our parent company, Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting. He's also the chairman of the National Emmy Awards. Terry, welcome to The Confluence.
Kevin, it's great to be here, especially a chance to sit in this studio when we're not trying to raise money to support this fine radio station.
Well, money is part of the problem that happened with this interruption. So these two local stations have been reading pleas on the air for about a week, scrolling messages on the bottom of the screen, asking viewers to call Verizon, AT&T, DirecTV to get their programming back. What goes on behind the scenes?
Well, remember that the cable TV companies and the satellite companies, they are essentially the middlemen in delivering television service to about 85% of American households. You know, cable TV was actually invented here in Pennsylvania back in the late 1940s in northeastern Pennsylvania as a way to get good TV in places where over-the-air television wasn't particularly good. But so now it's, you know, they are the middleman, and that is what it is. We can still get fine over-the-air television by putting an antenna up on the roof and maybe having to put one of those things that steer your antenna. That seems like an old-fashioned way to do it, but it works really well.
It was under the 1992 Cable Television Act. Either side can actually pull the plug on the programming. cable and satellite providers or the local stations if they can't agree on compensation. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Basically, what it came down to was the fact that up until that time, local television stations hoped they would get on cable because they really wanted to be seen in those homes. But increasingly, as the dollars have shifted and the business has shifted, the local stations have said, well, hey, we would like to be paid if you, the cable company, or you, the satellite company, is going to carry our signal and, oh, by the way, mark it up and make money on your own. And so that becomes the area of competition.
So how much money are we talking about here?
A decade or so ago, it wasn't very much money. Very few stations made money out of compensation. Today, for many television stations, this money that they get paid or that their parent company gets paid by the cable or satellite companies is perhaps the largest chunk of their revenue. 10 years ago, it was virtually nothing. This year, probably something north of $11 billion for the industry. So it's really significant dollars.
So the stakes have gotten much higher.
Absolutely. And remember that the audiences are shifting, too. If you're a local television station, you're looking at the fact that the number of people, especially young people, who are watching linear television, who are, you know, tuning in for prime time, that's dropping, which means their advertising model is challenged. And so they need to find other places to make their money.
If all this comes down to a shifting media landscape, is there any comparison to be made with what newspapers, other media are experiencing right now?
Well, sure. To the extent that consumers are taking advantage of technology to get their news or to get their programming, their entertainment and information other places, it means that the business models of companies like this have to change. And so in much the same way that newspapers have found that, oh, they've got this heavy burden of maintaining a large printing plant and it's really expensive and the cost of distribution of having people going out and putting those papers on your doorstep first thing in the morning is expensive, as contrasted to distributing content by digital, which is far less expensive, the business models have to follow the consumer.
So are different parties fighting for the same dollars then?
Well, yeah, and in some cases it's a shrinking pool of dollars. So we increasingly see in the television business what we call cord cutters. People have decided, I don't want to pay for cable. I don't want to pay for satellite. I can get free television over the air, so that's what I'm going to do. And so between the cable companies and the broadcast television companies, they are competing for a certain set of dollars, and they're going to do the best they can in what feels to them to be a very, very challenged industry.
So some viewers were upset last week about the disruption. But this has happened before.
Oh, no kidding. When my wife Eileen couldn't watch Jeopardy, was it Monday or Tuesday night, she was incensed. But like these things, they tend to settle. These contracts run for 2 or 3 years. I would expect in 2 or 3 years, there'll be another scuffle of this sort.
But it was really a short interruption compared to some other markets, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, there was a Dish Network disruption in Florida last year that went for more than 6 months. And I can tell you, if we lost Jeopardy in my house for 6 months, my wife would have me up on the roof putting in an antenna.
So it comes down to every time a contract comes up, there is the possibility this will happen again.
Yeah, that's true. And again, as the technology is going to continue to change, the pressures are going to continue to increase. People are increasingly going to have lots of different choices for where they get their video entertainment. You can expect that this will happen more and more.
Terry O'Reilly is the CEO of Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting Corporation and the chairman of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Thanks so much.
Hey, no problem. Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A question. How many times leading up to or during the holidays did you hear the Christmas song? Or as many people probably refer to it, the Chestnuts Roasting Song. Francesca DeBecco is a Pittsburgh-based writer who's fallen deep down the chestnut tree rabbit hole. Francesca, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your story for the online food magazine Heated, you trace the history of and the decline of chestnuts domestically. Have you ever seen an American chestnut tree, ever roasted a chestnut over an open fire?
I have not, actually. And that's sort of what interested me in this whole story is that it's really associated with the holidays, yet I've never seen a chestnut tree. I've never roasted them myself. So where did this association come from? So that's kind of why I decided to explore that topic.
So full disclosure, I've never eaten a chestnut myself. Do you know what they taste like? Any similarities to other nuts?
Yeah, so chestnuts are a whole different variety of nuts. They can be used in sweet dishes as well as savory, and they have a dense, meaty texture. But really, I've only had them within dishes and only around the holiday times.
These trees, they used to be everywhere, all over the United States, certainly here in Western Pennsylvania. Give us a sense of their importance around the turn of the last century.
Right. So there were as many as 200 million acres of American chestnut trees stemming from Maine all the way to Georgia. And they towered throughout all of the eastern U.S. And they really were an important way of life for so many people.
How so?
So the people who lived in Appalachia, they used the chestnuts to feed their livestock, perhaps their hogs, and sell those animals or feed for themselves. They would use them and trade them for other goods at local shops, such as sugar or shoes. Mm-hmm. And the lumber was really sought after because it was rot resistant. So every part of the chestnut tree was used, and it really defined a way of life for these people.
So what happened to them, to the American chestnut tree?
So it was in 1904 when the blight was first detected, and it was detected in New York State, and over the next four decades, it spread by foot, air, wildlife, and basically destroyed the entire American chestnut population.
You say that the fungus came from Asia around 1904?
Yes. Basically, there was nothing they could do to stop it. And still today, chestnut trees are affected. They can grow. They can produce saplings, but they grow no more than like the size of a bush.
But we still see chestnuts in the market, especially this time of year during the holiday season. So where are they coming from?
Yeah, so all of our imports are mostly from Italy or China. And what's interesting is that this association that we have during the holiday season in the winter months, it doesn't stem from just what we've had in imports. It comes from the American chestnut in our history of having it in our land.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, talking to writer Francesca DeBecco about her recent profile of an iconic holiday image, chestnuts, in efforts to restore the trees themselves. The American chestnut tree is now considered to be functionally extinct, but you found a group of researchers who hope to change this. Tell us a little bit more about the American Chestnut Foundation.
Yeah, so I talked with a woman named Sarah Fitzsimmons from the American Chestnut Foundation, the local branch here in Pennsylvania, and they are working to restore this species back to native land.
What are they doing to make the American chestnut tree more resistant to the fungus that wiped out so many trees decades ago?
Yeah, so they have a three-BRRRR approach, as they call it, which is for breeding, biocontrol, and biotechnology. For three generations, the offspring from two fungus-resistant chestnut hybrids have been bred with American chestnut, producing a genetically diverse population that hopefully can be more tolerant of the blight. And for biocontrol, it's essentially them trying to make the fungus sick. So think about kicking in the tree's natural defense system. And for biotechnology, it sounds exactly as it said. It's all about genetic engineering. And there's actually a group of scientists from the College of Environmental Science at New York State that discovered a gene that is in wheat that actually will help to make the tree more tolerant to the blight. But they're still waiting on federal approval. So all of these things are working together to try to find the best option in restoring this important, iconic tree species back to Appalachia.
So the original species has been gone for about 80 years. And now we've got a scientific community working to restore a tree that they've never even seen.
Right. It's actually really inspiring because although they've never stood under these soaring branches of the American chestnut tree, they've been handed down this passion from past generations, because the American chestnut was this really important tree in American history.
So how are they going to know if they got it right?
That's interesting. I know that they look for indicators of what the original American chestnut was like. They were a smaller nut compared to Asian and European varieties, as well as they were incredibly tall and massive. Think of them as sort of like the redwoods of eastern U.S.
Can these efforts to restore the chestnut tree, can they also be helpful to other kinds of forest land? Regarding, say, biodiversity of the forest?
Right. So that is actually one of the main goals with this effort, is that if they are successful at restoring the American chestnut tree to its native land, then perhaps they can use that same model to protect other endangered species of trees. And of course, biodiversity in our forests is important for wildlife and everything. So it would be a really key environmental success for the American Chestnut Foundation.
So at this point, what kind of progress have they made? Are you or I likely to see an American chestnut or a hybrid chestnut tree in the wild anytime soon, or lining up on some chestnut street in any town USA?
I can't answer that for sure, but
I
know.
Well, how hopeful are they?
They're pretty hopeful. I think that they're working on a trial basis right now, and in sort of small groups of chestnut trees, and sort of breeding them for that purpose. But I think hopefully, when I talked to Sarah Fitzsimmons from the American Chestnut Foundation, she imagined a world where we would go chestnut picking just as we would, picking apples in the fall time or blueberry picking in the summer. And I believe in her hope for the future, and I hope that we can see it be restored to native land.
Francesca DeBecca is a Pittsburgh-based writer. Her profile of the American chestnut tree first appeared online in the Mark Bittman magazine, Heated. We'll have a link to it on our website at WESA.FM. Francesca, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. If you're like me, you wait to the end of the holidays to take down your tree. Fortunately, if you have a live tree, you still have an opportunity to do the environmentally responsible thing. Recycle that tree. Joining me on the line is Teresa Bradley, the recycling supervisor for the City of Pittsburgh's Department of Public Works. Teresa, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Teresa, do you have a live tree?
I actually do have a live tree, and I've had the same tree for 5 years. What do you think about that one?
So you recycle, you take it back outside then, right?
Yeah, we absolutely do. Our family does, and we're looking to plant that tree in the spring. It is 82 inches tall.
Oh, yeah. Just about a 7-footer. So this is an annual activity by the city, the recycling of the trees. You've expanded the number of drop-off locations this year. Why? Was it residents saying, hey, how about something closer to us?
Absolutely. This is actually a joint effort with the mayor's office, the Bureau of Environmental Services, and also community affairs. So we're just ecstatic. We already have hundreds of trees already collected. This program started December 26th, and it runs through January 26th of this year. And we have expanded the program. We now have 9 satellite drop-off locations, and we have a total of 12 because we also have our divisions that take, accept yard debris and trees year-round.
Is there any way to tell how many city residents do not recycle their trees? In other words, they leave them at the curbside. Do public works employees sort of do an informal count of trees that wind up getting tossed into refuse trucks and then eventually hauled away to landfills?
Actually, I have a short answer to that. And this program really got ramped up last year, and we expanded to 10 sites, and the year prior was 3. So after interviewing some informal interviews with our refuse and recycling workers, they have mentioned that they've seen a decrease at trees at the curb. And last year we collected over 21 tons and over 2,000 trees. And this year we've already collected over a couple hundred. So we've really seen an improvement, an increase in this program, and actually an appetite for it. So it's exciting.
21. How do you come up with that figure? How do you weigh trees?
Well, as a diversion girl, no, we actually work with our vendor. The city of Pittsburgh has a vendor, Wood Waste. They give us the numbers, and we're actually, when our recycling workers go out to these satellite locations to collect these trees, then they drop them off at our forestry department. They're actually counting those trees as well. But we're getting the tonnages from our vendor. And so it's kind of nice because we can gauge, you know, and see, you know, where we are as a program.
So there's not mulching at each of these drop-off sites. It's all mulched at one site. Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. So everything is picked up at the satellite locations, and then they go to one central location, and they'll be chipped. And then in the spring, we'll have four mulch collection events where residents can, you know, use them for a vegetable garden. They can use them for just various applications.
So how big does this mound of mulch look when you're done collecting and chipping?
Well, to be honest with you, the city of Pittsburgh has mulch year-round, and we're actually looking at exploring some alternative ways to get that mulch out to the public. So I think this is, we're hoping the catalyst or the change that might, you know, kind of get this information out and get the appetite and get residents excited about collecting, you know, mulch year-round. But as of for right now, we're doing the four locations. The pile actually does get pretty large. And last year we had over 400 residents that participate in the mulch collection program. So the appetite is there.
So hopefully they're bringing their trees, dropping off their trees, and then yep, they're benefiting from the mulching process for their own gardens, et cetera.
I would like to say it's a full closed loop system because it saves Pittsburgh money, right? We're not taking these trees to the landfill. We're diverting valuable materials from, you know, the landfill and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, not transporting them all over. And it also creates buy-in for the public, right? You know, if you've purchased a tree, you might do it on a Saturday and you're spending all that time. Why not spend a little extra time bringing that tree to one of our drop-off locations and recycling it responsibly?
If you don't run out of the mulch from people coming by to pick up some, do you use that in city parks?
Absolutely. And with our vendor Wood Waste, we're actually able to collect up to 10% of that final product and bring it back to the city of Pittsburgh to use it at ball fields and to use it in neighborhoods and community gardens. Absolutely.
How does the tree recycling program sort of fit into other city environmental programs?
Well, there's many initiatives. The mayor's committed to zero waste by 2030. So that fits into that roadmap to zero waste. And in addition, the climate action plan. And I think at the Bureau of Environmental Services, it also, I mean, it's near and dear to my heart because being in the industry for quite some time, I understand, you know, those environmental impacts and keeping things local. But I think it's a feel-good thing, too. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you purchase this tree, you don't really know what to do with it in the end, but it was a live tree at one point, right? And so it's getting folks to understand, to think of, you know, the full circle of, you know, closing the loop. And so, yeah, there's many different programs and folks that are really involved in this program to make it happen. So it's not completely easy, but it's something that we're committed to doing to, you know, increase our diversion for the city of Pittsburgh.
The city is providing the 12 drop-off sites through January 26th. The county park locations are accepting trees through January 14th. We'll have a link to all of the locations on our website, WESA.FM. Teresa Bradley is the recycling supervisor for the city's Public Works Department. Teresa, thanks so much.
You're welcome, and Happy New Year, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, for only the second time in its history, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra has selected a principal pops conductor to begin later this year. Who is he? What inspired him to come to Pittsburgh? Tune in tomorrow to hear about the new sound of the PSO Pops. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caldwell Holton. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.